So when was your last checkup? Oh no, not you. Although that's important too, but when was your last vehicle checkup? When it comes to service, nobody knows your Chevy better than your local Chevy dealer. Go to ChevyDriveChicago.com to schedule an appointment today.
Happy Tuesday, live from the Skyline Studios, high above Columbus and Wacker Drive. It's me, Anna D., Anna DeVlantis, here on WGN 1 to 3 every day with you. And I want to tell you what's coming up on the show. And then I want to get to a story that was trending last night. Did you watch the LSU-Clemson game? Did you see?
So good.
Oh, wow. My husband had it on. I got to say, I was kind of walking around doing a lot of things, but it was. I just sat down on the couch at one point and said, I have to watch this. Really a good game.
Joe Burrow is a beast. Can we just all agree on that?
What year is he, Lauren? He's
senior, I believe.
So he'll be a big draft prospect.
Oh, absolutely.
Huge. But the story that was trending had nothing to do with the game, had nothing to do with Burrow, who is a rock star stud and soon to be in the NFL. And so many other things about that game that were amazing. High scoring game, right? A lot of things about that game that were just exciting. Exciting to watch. But the story that we want to get to is coming up just in a minute. Somebody at the game and why that started trending all last night. Number 8 nationwide, number 5 here in Chicago. But first, I want to just tell you a couple things about the other things, other stories and other issues we'll be covering here on the show today. Quiet rooms. I don't know if you followed this Tribune investigation about this. They are solitary confinement essentially for children. The Tribune and ProPublica have done more than a year-long investigation and collected so much data and really dug in deep about places, schools across Illinois that were using these solitary confinement rooms and the rules and the laws and if they were being followed. And some of it is just heartbreaking, frankly. It has led to an emergency order by the governor to stop this practice of using them. And we're going to follow up with those reporters. They've been so busy because their reporting has led to it seems like it may lead to legislation at some point.
I was so shocked by the details of that story, so I'm so glad that you're going to go in depth today, because it just seemed unbelievable. It didn't seem like something that could happen in America.
And not in CPS. They don't use them in Chicago public schools, but they are used across the state. When we talked about this first, we did hear from some parents whose own children mm-hmm. were locked up in these rooms. And I get it. I come from a family of educators. My sister, teacher. My mom worked as a clerk in the Chicago public schools for 20 years. You have kids who have bad behavioral problems, and they are difficult to deal with, and they are disruptive in classrooms, and that is hard. And yet, when they really dug in deeper on how these were being used, there were a lot of real problems.
And were they isolated, completely alone in these rooms?
These rooms can be, there are rules, and I don't want to deep into that, but they can be quite small, little rooms, almost closet-like, and they can be padded rooms where a child could be locked in them for the entire day, for the whole day.
Shocking.
Now, there are rules about having a person present outside of them. They can't be locked in case there's a fire drill. All kinds of things there to get into.
Got it.
But what they found and the follow-ups to that original reporting is really what we want to dig in with them today.
Glad you're going to explore that and go in depth.
Because a lot there, right, Jean?
Yes.
A lot there. The top trending story. Oh, also we'll talk about tech in Illinois. How are we doing after we lost Amazon headquarters too? Some stories about how the tech sector is doing in Chicago. It is the area of growth for the future. Are we growing jobs here? Are we keeping our very, very smart people here who are in that area? What's to come? We're going to have Howard Tolman and Scott Catoon of Technori. Howard Tolman used to run 1871 here in Chicago, the big incubator for tech startups in Chicago. They're going to weigh in on where we are and if Elon Musk is ever going to build that tunnel, that tunnel that's going to take us to O'Hare in 2.2 seconds or
Isn't
whatever he promised.
Busy going to the moon right now, taking billionaires and millionaires on commercial flights to the moon.
He's a very busy guy, and he makes a lot of promises that he doesn't always deliver on. That's all I'm going to say about Elon Musk.
I think his girlfriend's pregnant, too, by the way.
And then he's running a reality show for the fellow billionaire who wants to take his girlfriend from the reality show winner to the moon.
Yeah, I was going to apply for that.
And you could be that lucky gal.
Yeah, I was going to apply. Just kidding.
Hey,
I am not.
Sounds like quite an offer. All right, the story that was trending yesterday, Vince Vaughn. He was at the LSU game, and you saw him shake hands with the president. He was pictured in kind of one of those swanky skybox sitting next to Melania and the president. And he was number 8 trending in the country. He was number 5 here in Chicago because he shook hands with the president and talked to him very nicely. I don't know if you guys saw that, but it was covered.
Yeah, I was kind of laughing because, you know, the trend of pretending to quote whatever they're saying, even though you can't hear them. Someone quoted part of the Wedding Crashers spiel when he's like, I love maple syrup. I love everything about maple syrup. And so it goes with the whole line as if he's saying that to
President is that
Trump.
A meme that's going around on social?
Well, it's the video as it's going around. Someone on Twitter is getting a lot of likes for that kind of post.
We know the cancel culture involved with Twitter and social media. And immediately, well, this one kind of sums it up for me. The Hill Media reporter Joan Concha asked, so do swingers and wedding crashers get taken off the air for all of eternity now after Vince Vaughn had a civilized conversation with the president at the Superdome tonight? He's being facetious there.
I have had the opportunity to interview Vince Vaughn a couple of times, mm-hmm. and he has always been superbly kind and nice. I think he's just, in my experience, a nice person.
I think even if you don't agree with the politics that, you know, are going on right now, there's nothing wrong with being a nice and civil person.
And didn't Ellen DeGeneres also get into a lot of,
remember,
it was trending when
she
was
sat next to George
Bush. Yeah.
At another game, I think it was a Cowboys game.
Right.
And she also took a lot of heat for how can you sit next to this person. And later she responded to it on her show and just said, this is being civil, guys.
Yeah,
this is okay. You don't have to agree with everything that the person represents in politics in order to be civil to someone. I thought it was a great speech. We need to try to cue that up for later.
Totally agree with what you're saying, Anna, and what Lauren is saying. It's about having manners. It's about being polite. It's about human decency. It's about treating others the way you would want to be treated. I don't know.
It goes too far.
Yeah.
It does. And you expect the internet to do that. But this one, it was just so strange to see that trending, the fact that he shook hands with the president and then sat next to him and talk to him. But that's where we are, folks, right now. Coming up here, though, on the show is the issue of Illinois. Where do we stand on gaming? You know, they passed the big bill, the big gaming bill in legislature. That was in June. And now where are we as Indiana racks up sales approaching a half a billion dollars in just 3 months of dealing with gaming and having it online and dealing with all the different areas of gaming. They're collecting taxes on that. We're not. We're going to find out why and when we will. ABC News and WGN News' Ryan Burrow will join us coming up. All right, Ryan Burrow is here with us, stepping into the studio. ABC News and WGN News, we share you, right? We get to share you and all the stories that you do, and you do great work. First of all, I want to say congratulations to the LSU quarterback, your relative, Joe Burrow. How is he related to you again? Joe Burrow?
He is not yet related to me, but I'm going to find a
get
way
on
to
ancestry.com.
Make him related to me. Yeah, I don't have any relatives from Iowa. Or actually, he's from Ohio. But Ohio. He went from Iowa to Ohio.
Transfer from Ohio State.
There you go. That's what it is. But
any relatives?
Unfortunately, I was talking with my father, who's also a Burrow, and he said, just go get the jersey when he becomes an NFL player. And that sounds like cool, because then I'd have my name on the back, but it's probably going to be a Cincinnati Bengal, and I don't think I want to wear that jersey.
No. Or a Packer. We wouldn't want that either.
Yeah, exactly.
He's like a backup to, you know, Aaron Rodgers.
Exactly, yeah.
But we'll be following. Maybe you'll get to cover him one day. Who knows? Let's talk about this, where it is front and center, because you sent me an email about this today. I thought, oh no, Illinois' gaming bill passed back in June, and there was a lot of hope that we'd get going and start collecting the tax dollars. If it's going to be legal, let's start collecting the taxes. And then the news that Indiana has taken in nearly $500 million, $436 million, wagered on sports. Now, the state doesn't get all of that. That's what was wagered from September 1st through December 31st of last year. So it's fascinating to see there got to be a lot of tax dollars associated with that. And, gee, wouldn't it be nice if that were here?
Yeah, $3.7 million pulled in by the state just over that September 1st through December 31st span. we don't have that here, and we passed it. So what are we waiting on? Because things move so quickly with the pot, right? I mean, all we've been talking about since January 1st is all the money that's been coming in and all the sales and all the lines. And why are we hearing just crickets when it comes to sports gaming? And I can tell you, I've talked with people at casinos here in Illinois. They're ready. They've got the TV screens. They've got the chairs. All they got to do is pull out the desks for the for the staff to begin taking those bets. But until they get the thumbs up from the Illinois Gaming Board, it's just not going to happen. Now, where they're at in their process is back in December, they did release the sports wagering applications and rules governing those applications. Now they go through this slow process of giving those, getting the applications and accepting people and moving forward. But we missed last night with the college football game, right?
Yeah.
We're probably going to miss the Super Bowl is what I'm hearing. This will not be enacted in time for the Super Bowl. Maybe March Madness, we'll see, but probably more likely around the summer.
So would you have bet on Joe Burrow last night if you could have bet in the state of Illinois?
I think I would have had to, right? But yeah. Here's the thing about the state of Illinois is, Hammond, we can almost see it from our window here. And
seriously,
people are going across the state. Now, I reached out to the Horseshoe Casino there to see how many people. They haven't gotten back to me yet on it. But a lot of these casinos have set up shop just on the border. So it's not just Illinois, but Kentucky and Ohio, along those borders there to try to entice some of the sports gambling there as well.
So the money shelled out on sports bets in Indiana during the state's first 4 months of legal gambling was more than the advertising revenue raked in for the Super Bowl, enough to match the net worth of LeBron James by 110 million Popeye's chicken sandwiches or snag the most expensive painting in the world, Leonardo da Vinci's Salvador Mundi.
What do you think of the number one sport? You may have read the article, but what do you think the number one sport people were betting on was?
Number one sport.
In
I did not
Indiana,
read that particular.
In
Indiana, is going to be basketball.
Actually, no, it was football. It may just be where the season fell, but $176 million in transactions on sports betting just in football alone.
I haven't been big on the best sports betting. I think once it is legal and really easy, and particularly once it gets to my phone and it's connected to something that's kind of interesting or alluring, I might get into it. I wonder here, if they look at who's actually doing the betting, as you open this up, are they bringing in new people, new revenue to this whole game? That's a lot of money.
Yeah, it is a lot of money. And, there is a novelty to it. I mean, I went across the border to get a couple bets in on just fun things for family members, Bears, Bulls, just fun things that they could keep an eye on. I think, here's the thing, for my father-in-law, a bet that the Bulls would win more than 34 games this season.
See, I love those kinds of bets. Are those called prop bets, those, like that kind of thing?
Yeah, well, there are prop bets. This
what's
was,
that?
I don't know what that one specifically
on that?
Is. I'm sure there are a lot of people
that?
Chiming in right now, but I went to Hammond and I told the guy, I'm like, I've never done this before. Very helpful, super helpful. I've never done this before. How do I want to bet on the Bulls for the season, and the bet was 34 wins. I don't know that they're going to do that, but probably not right now. But, it's fun and it was a novelty and I gave it as a gift, and to think I had to go across the state lines to do
that. Yeah. And you wonder how much of that revenue is from people crossing the border from Illinois.
Exactly.
Quote of the day: you can download an app and bet on a college football game after two beers. Who wouldn't want to do that?
Yeah,
it's
the
professor of economics who said that.
The online market is going to be interesting as well, because we're talking about the hard locations, right? So we've been talking about Rivers Casino and the Joliet Casino, and obviously the Hammond Casino. Those are hard locations you have to go and walk into and place your bet, physically place your bet. But the online is going to change things considerably, and maybe Illinois is banking on getting that right. And then away we go.
Well, let me ask you more about that, because the background here is important. The U.S. Supreme Court paved the way for states to legalize sports betting. That was May of 2018. So here we are, January 2020, and there's been a lot of time here, you would think. And these are complex things, and there are issues with gambling addiction. There are,
sure,
there are all kinds of fairness issues to sort out, where you place a casino, what all kinds of things, and who gets ownership. We understand this. We've gone through this with Mayor Ron. But it feels as if they've had a lot of time in Illinois to get this worked out. Do you have any feeling about when or what exactly might be sort of the holdup? Is it just going through the details?
I think that's what it is. It's just getting through these details and making sure they've crossed all their T's and dotted all their I's. You've got a lot of things in play right now. We know that the mayor has been talking here in Chicago about a casino and the struggle of just finding a location and finding bidders that would accept it and all the tax money. We know the issues that are going on right now with the Arlington racetrack. I mean, why is it that they don't want to become a casino? Why is it that Churchill Downs doesn't want to do that? Are they looking to sell? Are there bidders out there? The Sun-Times had a report last week that there were two bidders potentially looking at the Arlington racetrack. So that could be a venue as well. There's so much that is kind of up in the air right now, and that's probably one of the reasons that the Illinois Gaming Board really wants to lock all this stuff down.
You mentioned Arlington and two potential bidders. It's because these horse tracks could become casinos, racinos, as
yes.
they like to
uh-huh.
call them, and that they become more profitable, I suppose, and that's where people would go then to place their bets. And in general, I think these casinos or racinos become entertainment zones. They have things for kids to do. You have little drop-off places to put the kids, and then you can go and hang out with grandma or grandpa. You can do whatever you want. It's
sure.
in multi-generational. It's kind of, they make it fun for everybody, whether you're playing the nickel slots or you're hitting the blackjack tables or whatever you want to do.
So why would Churchill Downs not want to do that? That's a big question. And that's what threw a lot of government officials off is, you know, we're going to open up these six casinos and what, you don't want to be one, Arlington? That doesn't make a lot of sense.
Well, they also own the one in Des Plaines, Churchill Downs.
Ah, there
right?
it is.
So it's geography.
They don't want to compete against themselves, perhaps.
Steve Bertrand from downtown. I like it. That was, it's a fascinating space. And I think as long as we are going to legalize it, we might as well get it worked out, and sooner rather than later, because of the tax dollars involved. You know, you look at marijuana in 12 days, $19.7 million in sales
yeah.
here in Illinois, more than any other state that rolled this out in the first couple weeks than California, which is a much larger state. And you look at, you know, there are problems and hiccups with the launch and the supply side in particular. But then you look at where the money's going to go. This is the question I've had all along, Ryan. Where's the money going to go? 35% of marijuana tax revenues go to the state's general fund.
Sure. Money you can push around for a
slush
whatever
fund.
Day.
Well, yeah. Slush fund. That's how I read that. 25% will go to restore, reinvest, and renew, and invest in communities most affected by the criminalization of marijuana. That seems right. 20% will go to address substance abuse and mental health. That's a big piece of it, necessary. 10% will go to pay the state's bills. 8% will be distributed among local governments and support law enforcement, and then 2% to education. I guess there might be a similar breakdown when it comes to casinos, but we've got to
I think a lot
devils
of the
details.
The sports betting, a lot of it would go to infrastructure, transportation. That was kind of what that was earmarked for.
Good. Good
Let's
to
get
know.
Those roads fixed. Hey, I wonder if this would have sped up a little bit if the Bears would have been better. If they would have been in the playoffs, if they would
Can
have been chasing
imagine?
A Super Bowl, do you think that all of a sudden this thing would have moved a little
I
quicker?
I do. That's how things work.
Yeah.
Ryan Burrow, ABC News and WGN Radio News. Thanks for weighing in on this.
Yep.
Appreciate it. Coming up here, much more after the news from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. Former Northwest Indiana guy, 630, my friends tell me there's always a line to place bets Thursday through Sunday. Wonder how many of those are Illinois people. Coming up, we're going to talk about those quiet rooms, a long-time investigation by Tribune reporter, and ProPublica reporter, and the results of what they did pretty much shut these quiet rooms down in schools. We'll talk about it coming up here on WGN. From the Skyline Studios, this is Anna DeVlantis. We're going to talk about that issue we've been mentioning from the top of the show, quiet rooms, they're called, and an investigation into them by several reporters here locally has basically shut them down. They have legislative hearings now. The state is looking, the Board of Ed is looking about whether or not they should even exist. The two of the reporters are here with me who broke this story, had been doing a data search and doing research and investigation on this issue for over a year and continue to follow it now. Bring us up to where we stand now. First of all, it's Jennifer Smith Richards of the Chicago Tribune. You've been following some of her work, I'm sure. Jody Cohen from ProPublica, Illinois. You worked together on this along with a number of other staffers and people. Any investigation like this takes a lot of people to put it all together. Give us the background first for people who don't know. What are quiet rooms and how did this first hit your radar? Jennifer, why don't you start?
Sure. So there's been a law in the books here in Illinois for a little over 20 years that allowed public schools to use a small space for isolation purposes. It's supposed to be for safety, but typically they are very small rooms. Many of them have padding, a door that can lock, that a staff member would stand outside and monitor from a window, or sometimes you know, a closed circuit camera or a peephole. And they're meant for students who are a physical danger to themselves or someone else. But what we learned after looking at more than 50,000 pages of incident reports that described how schools were using these rooms is that they were not being used for safety reasons. They were being used in many cases to discipline students or to punish them for bad behavior.
Yeah, that was the part you talk about very top of the story. There are, have gentle names, the reflection room, the cool down room, the calming room, the quiet room. And yet kids as young as five, some of them with developmental disability or developmental issues or any kind of challenges, kids who maybe didn't really meet the state law for qualifying for being in these rooms and being using them, were shut in there. And they took notes, apparently, outside of these rooms about what those kids were saying. And you include that in your reporting. That took a lot of work to go find those notes, but you assembled them, didn't you?
That's right. And the law actually required schools, the staff who are monitoring seclusion rooms, to keep very detailed notes of why the child was in there, what happened when the child was inside. So you would actually see the staff recording the child's words, their direct quotes, what they were doing, and what the staff was doing and how the staff was reacting or not to the child inside. And so, yes, we filed public records requests and got all those documents to be able to tell what had happened to the children and what they said while inside those rooms.
Jody, you've been on this reporting as well. And I mean, great work. I know it's kind of hard to even say that because it's had to be a very heavy thing to be covering and to be going through and reading these kinds of documents. You're dealing with children and children in distress, and you're dealing with educators who were probably stressed as well. And we know that there aren't always ideal conditions in schools either when it comes to dealing with children that are disruptive in the classroom. What were your observations, Jody, as you went through this? When did you sort of start feeling that there was something there to keep digging deeper?
So as Jennifer said, the law required that students only be put in seclusion or be physically restrained if they were a safety threat to themselves or somebody else. And we would read through the records and these incident reports and see that children were being disruptive, or they weren't following directions, or they, you know, they weren't coming in from recess when they were told to come in. They weren't finishing a math problem. They were, you know, not. They were disrupting a classroom, and they would be, you know, taken to a seclusion room. And we were able to see that in about a third of the times when students were secluded, that there was no safety issue. And we started to see this pattern. We would see a student would be in a seclusion room and saying things like, "I'm sorry, I ripped the paper. Just let me out. Just please let me out of here." And this wasn't something that we saw in isolation. You know, this was something that we saw at schools across the state.
"Let me out of here. I'm crying alone. I just need my mom." Things that are difficult to read, difficult to hear. When you talked with them, Jennifer, the educators, about it, what did they say about any of the, if you had an opportunity to, what was their response to the use that's highlighted in your story or series of reports, I should say?
Right. We heard a couple of different things from educators, you know, again, in all parts of the state. One is, I don't know what else to do. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure what else you do with a kid who you think is out of control or who is being noncompliant or disruptive or refusing to be, you know, a student. They felt like they did not have other options, and they hadn't been trained to do something other than use the seclusion room or, in some cases, use a physical restraint. And the other thing we heard is that it's traumatic for the staff, too. Like, it's not a good day at work mm-hmm. if you have to go to school and put a child essentially in a closet-sized space and lock the door. Like, that's not fun for anybody. Nobody wants to be doing it. So I think that, you know, one of our takeaways was this caused trauma for both kids and the staff members who, you know, are dealing something very, very difficult, some very challenging behavior at school.
Can you describe what the rooms look like? Because it does vary school to school what they might look like. Are they padded? How big are they? Where are they? I mean, are they in a closet or are they just a defined room? Schools don't have a lot of extra rooms, so I don't know what they necessarily use for the quiet room. Can you talk about how they varied, you know, school to school, what you saw? Were you able to get in and see them?
We were able to get into only a few schools. Most schools would not allow us to go into the school, would not allow us to see the seclusion rooms. We did go to a couple, and we also submitted public records requests to districts so that we could see floor plans and the dimensions of the rooms. And we were able to determine that often the rooms are off of a hallway. Sometimes they're within a classroom, but you know, they're in hallways, and sometimes they're padded and sometimes they're not. They're very small, barren, you know, nothing inside. And
not a toy or an educational device, a book, nothing like that. So they really are left alone.
Maybe a security camera and a light on the ceiling. But there is nothing in there that's soothing or, you know, it's just a room. Some parents describe them as cells.
And were they very big? Were they small? Is there a state law about how big they have to be?
There's no state law about how big they have to be. They have to be the same height as the rooms around them. And that is because when the law was enacted 20 years ago, it was in response to a plywood box that was put in the center of a classroom. And students were at a school were being put inside that box. So when the law was written, the room had to be the same height as the rooms around it. But it did not say it had to be 10 feet by 10 feet minimum. I mean, so some of them are like a closet, like maybe a walk-in closet or a tiny bathroom.
The light has to be on. Is that part of it?
Or? No. I'm just saying a light is maybe something that would be in one of the rooms. There's just nothing in the room.
There's nothing in the room for them to do or anything like that. They have to remain unlocked for fire code reasons, I saw in your reporting, and timeouts can be used only to protect the safety of students or staff or for therapeutic reasons, not as punishment for obedience or other infractions.
Well, they actually could be locked, but an adult, it had to be an active lock, meaning that an adult had to be holding a lock, like a magnetic lock, or holding a handle up to keep the door locked so that if there were a fire or another safety danger and the adult were to leave, the child would not be left inside the room, locked inside.
630 does ask that question. Jennifer, what's the difference between this and a timeout? Put them in a room, call police and parents? Let's not make a big deal of it, because I think some parents think, well, what else are educators supposed to do? Why is this different than a timeout?
Right. Well, it is by definition very different than a timeout. So when you're talking about seclusion, what you're really talking about is something that's involuntary. So it's the involuntary removal of a child from class, and you're keeping them in a space they cannot leave from it. They don't want to be there, right? So when we think about timeout, we think about our own kids. You think, you know, you might want to take them away from the classroom, give them a few seconds to think and to calm and to maybe talk with a staff member. That's not a seclusion, nor is a sensory space. So you'll hear a lot of times people talk about, you know, kids with autism who might have some sensitivity to a lot of sound or a lot of commotion. And so some schools have sensory spaces or movement rooms where kids could choose to go and calm themselves. They might have a large swing. They might have beanbag chairs, like you mentioned, some soothing tools. That's not seclusion, and that's not something that we addressed in our stories. What we're really talking about is this very punitive, most of the time, use of a seclusion room. What we logged were staff members, you know, literally dragging children, you know, kicking and screaming and begging not to go into a seclusion room and putting them inside and locking the door.
I'd like to hear from, I want to hear from you, if you're a teacher or a parent or someone familiar with these, what your experience has been, if you have an experience with them, 312-981-7200, because I imagine educators do get to a point where it's so difficult to deal with that child who is disruptive in the classroom, and what do you do? There are alternatives. They don't use it in Chicago public schools. There are no quiet rooms. 19 states have banned them. They don't use them, and it looks like, because of your reporting, we're on our way to some legislative decision-making on this very issue. We're going to be back with more with Jody Cohen and Jennifer Smith Richards from Chicago Tribune. Jody's from ProPublica. They're two of the reporters who broke this story back in the fall and have continued to report on it as the state continues to take up this very important issue of quiet rooms. Back with more from the WGN Skyline Studios in a moment. Back live in the Skyline Studio, we're talking about quiet rooms, these solitary confinement rooms that are used for across the state for discipline and other reasons. The two reporters who broke this story and really brought it to the attention of all of us, but lawmakers. Some people, of course, have had personal experiences with quiet rooms. They are not in the Chicago Public Schools, but they are present across the state. Jennifer Smith Richards is with the Chicago Tribune. Jody Cohen is a reporter for ProPublica, Illinois. They worked together on this very in-depth series of reports and investigation and compiled a lot of data. That data is now being reviewed by state lawmakers. You heard the governor weigh in about it. 19 states do not allow quiet rooms. In the state of Illinois, they still are legal, obviously, and they're taking a hard look at should they be. We want to hear from Janice. You have a son with Down syndrome, and has your son been in those quiet rooms? Tell us about your experience. Janice, you're on WGN. Can you hear us?
Yes. Can you hear me?
I got you.
Okay, good. So, yes, thanks for taking my call. My son is 19, and he has Down syndrome and severe autism. And I, as a parent, am all for the quiet rooms. I think that when they're used appropriately, they can be a very wonderful tool to help your child de-escalate their behavior. And some days when you have a nonverbal child in a classroom, you don't always know why they're becoming increasingly aggressive or destructive, or they're starting to hit their head, or they're starting to be aggressive towards staff. So, like, for my son in his school, they have, like, what is called a break card, mm-hmm. and he can hand them the break card, and that means he wants to go in the quiet room. Because the quiet room, yes, they're padded, and my son's school is about 9 feet by 9 feet, and they're padded for the child's safety, mm-hmm. because my son will hit his head literally on walls and floors when he's upset.
Janice, did they tell you, the school, did they let you know that your child was in there and they gave you a reporting of what was happening? Because I know that's one of the requirements, but that is the piece that they exposed didn't always happen.
Yes, and I always like to know, because sometimes, and I kind of keep track of that myself, because since my son is nonverbal, he can say a few words, but he's considered a praxic nonverbal, and because I kind of keep track of that, like, okay, did he have a rough morning? Is it medication related? They call it an antecedent, like what caused him to escalate his behavior? Were there some other kids in the classroom at the moment? Were they very loud? Were they disruptive? Were there other kids having a really difficult day? And so therefore that caused my son, his whole sensory system to get out of whack. Mm-hmm. So for my son, I'm just speaking positively. His school in Palatine is awesome. They use it very appropriately. And it does help kids to really de-escalate their behavior, kind of collect themselves. They don't use it as a punishment at all.
Now, just one final question, and we have another parent we want to get to, but was it okay for you that there was nothing in that room to pass his time, or is that probably
it's
preferred?
It's totally fine. Okay. It's totally fine. My son actually likes it quiet, and you don't want toys in there because, especially if they're already hitting their head, they will take the toy, like he will take his juice bottle and smash it on his head. Mm-hmm. So that's why there's nothing in the room, and they kind of just need to de-escalate. It's kind of like if we're overwhelmed at work, or, you know, a coworker's driving us crazy. What do? Well, we might go into the bathroom and just kind of take some slow, deep breaths and kind of compose ourselves. Mm-hmm. That's kind of like what this is for.
Well, I appreciate that explanation, because it sounds as if when they're used correctly, that there is an appropriate use for them. Janice, thank you for your call. I want to get the reporters to weigh in on that, because did you see appropriate use? And again, we go back to the situation with educators trying to figure out how to deal with a situation that's escalating and disruptive in the schools.
Yeah, so what Janice described
what Janice described, you know, we can all relate to. Like, you have a, you're overwhelmed and you might need to step away. But what she described with a break card and choosing to go and calm down somewhere, or us as adults needing to step away and collect ourselves, that's voluntary, right? And by definition, seclusion is involuntary. So what Janice is describing is not even exactly what we're addressing here.
But what, the child doesn't really have an option, though, to say, I'm done with the seclusion now, in any case. But isn't it up to the educators to say, it looks as if they've calmed down now, and it looks like they can go back into class or not?
It's up. It should be up to the student if it's not a seclusion. So if it is truly like a quiet time.
Can a six-year-old really decide, or a seven-year-old really decide, I'm done in here, I'm okay now?
Has your child ever said, you know, I think I feel better now? I'm okay.
That, I guess you would know as a teacher when it's credible and when it's not, or sure, or not. And then what if they continue to act up? I'm just trying to understand. Yeah. You know, I come from a family of everyone's teachers. My mom worked in Chicago schools for 20 years. She was a clerk. She dealt with discipline, all kinds of discipline. She has so many stories. It is a hard thing when you're trying to teach, you're trying to have a productive environment, and you have children of all different needs, and you have all different sorts of things, and you're trying to make sure that classroom is not disruptive. So my heart Absolutely. Is there with them, and I know yours is too. We're trying to understand how these, if there is even a use, as we just heard Janice say, that would be okay.
Yeah, so one thing to keep in mind is that the law was clear about this, that the only time you could use seclusion, the only instance, is if there was a physical safety issue. So it was not appropriate to put a child in a room hoping that they'll be calm or to try to force them to behave a certain way. That simply wasn't legal in the state of Illinois. It was absolutely for a physical emergency. And so if you're using it for any other reason, it simply didn't meet the requirements of the law.
630, times have changed. My school used to put me in the cloakroom just for talking in class. I guess at least I had the cloaks to look at. So what do you do when a child is out of control? Is call the parent and have them come pick him or her up. It's outrageous that that's not an option. I dealt with this for 30 years as a school secretary. That's what my mom did. Parents need to take responsibility, which has mostly been put out on the schools. How do you guys feel about that?
Well, I think what educators and some disability advocates and experts have said and are saying publicly is that there needs to be training to identify what is causing the child's behavior. So not to be in a position where the educators are reacting to the behavior, but to figure out, you know, why is a student getting upset during math? And why is a student, you know, behavior changing because they want to come in from recess? So to figure out, to have more training in identifying trauma and crises and how to de-escalate and more positive interventions so that you're not getting to a situation where you feel like the only solution is to put a child in a seclusion room or to physically hold them down.
Karen, we'd like to get you to weigh in here. We have a caller named Karen. You wanted to thank both of these reporters here. You followed some of the reporting. Is that right, Karen? You're on WGN.
Hi, yes. My name is Karen Sandy. Hi, Jody. Hi, Jennifer. You guys are definitely my family's heroes.
Hi.
To further address a few of these things, my grandson is diagnosed with ADHD. Mm-hmm. He did not have an IEP plan going into the behavioral school. He was there for diagnostic evaluation, and we were even told that he couldn't be in a school system unless he went to CEDAW school. So here he's landed in a place without an IEP plan, no defining information about, hey, you know, if he acts like he's upset, you know, give him a fidget. He likes Transformers. He likes to go under a table. So those things were not even in place to be implemented to help my grandson cope. I have seen video. His video was, I believe, one of the only ones released, if not the only one, where the surveillance camera, you know, showed what the paraprofessionals did. Yes.
Karen, we're running low on time here. You're basically saying that you were okay with the reporting showing that what was wrong with this whole situation, that was, you think that's going to be helpful to other parents?
Absolutely. Many of them don't even know what's going on. And identifying and being aware and educated in behavior, the triggers, the antecedents, as the other woman spoke of, mm-hmm. is very important, and that's not being done. They were used when my grandson kicked the door in the school.
Karen, we're going to have to leave it there because we're running short on time here. This is such an issue and obviously impacting so many parents. I appreciate you weighing in and calling in to the show and telling us your experiences with them. Quickly, guys, tell us where we are here in the state of Illinois. Are they're taking a look at this? They're going to move forward potentially? You think we'll come to a ban? They'll ban them altogether?
So right now, they did put an emergency rule in place that says you cannot have a locked, isolated seclusion. So anytime a child is having trouble calming, a staff member has to go into a room with them and sit there with them. They can't lock the door. Mm-hmm. And the legislature is taking this up as well. You know, while the State Board of Education is making new rules that would be permanent, that would define when, if at all, you can use seclusion, there are a couple of legislators that have bills that would at this moment ban the use of seclusion in Illinois.
You'll be following it, and I hope you keep us posted about it. It's a significant issue and a lot of opinions about what's going on in the state. So keep us posted and let us know. We've got Jennifer Smith Richards of the Chicago Tribune and Jody Cohen from ProPublica, Illinois. Good reporting, guys. Keep us posted.
Thank you.
We will.
More to come here on WGN Radio. Stay with us. And then the news from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. Back live in the Skyline studio, this is Anna DeVlantis. We were talking last half hour about quiet rooms, and after getting so many texts and your calls, thank you for them, I've decided we need to have our guests back again. The two reporters who've been tracking that story, and what a story it is, movement in state legislature, they're taking a look at that, so a lot of developments to come on the quiet rooms, and they have promised me as they walked out of the studio that, yes, they will come back. But let's talk about who is in studio right now with us. We've got two exceptional men in the tech world to talk all things tech in Chicago. Howard Tolman, he used to run, as CEO, the city's giant entrepreneurial startup incubator, 1871, a huge success story here in Chicago. Now he writes a weekly column on tech and entrepreneurship for Inc. magazine and runs his own biz. We've also got Scott Catoon. He's always here, CEO of Technori. You can see him. We love his scene. Not that you're always here, like, oh, it's a big deal.
I pretty much am.
You're always in the hallways, and I'm like, Scott, get in here. We've got to talk about something, and you know these things. So your brain works
sometimes
in this way.
That's fast talker.
Very special. And your show on WGN Radio airs Saturdays, noon to 1.
Yes.
Check that out. All right, guys, I want to talk. So many people wonder about where we are with tech in Chicago. Those are jobs of growth for the future. I think that's a pretty fair statement. And how is Chicago doing when it comes to attracting tech talent, attracting tech startups, businesses? We lost Amazon headquarters too, but are we still doing okay? Howard, what's your view, your macro view on how it looks for us?
Well, first of all, I'm not sure that we've lost the part of Amazon that really matters, because Amazon is slowly sneaking into every city and adding tens of thousands of jobs. So we lost the opportunity to spend a few billion dollars that the state didn't have in order to encourage Amazon. But I'm pretty encouraged. I'm encouraged because one of the things we're seeing is people moving back to the city from both coasts, where they are just kidding themselves if they think they'll ever own a home in San Francisco or ever live in Manhattan, frankly. So they're coming back here for quality of life. They're coming back here for standard of living, you know, all of these kinds of things. And because almost every major tech company is here now, too. So, you know, you don't have this issue. If you want to work for Facebook or Salesforce or, you know, Google or Yelp or you name it, they're going to have a substantial presence in Chicago. So when you can combine that opportunity and the mobility, you know, one of the issues about going to the coast was if your first job didn't work out, there'd be 20 other jobs.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? That was not the case when somebody was moving back to Chicago a while ago, but today I think it is. I think there's plenty of safety net in terms of that. So I'm pretty encouraged, and I think our pool of tech is growing. I think it's not diverse, you know, that we had this project at Kaplan to try and take the 30 or 40% of the students there that are all tech students, and 30 or 40% of them are first in their family to go to college. So it's completely transformational and all diverse, and helped to build a new kind of pipeline into the Chicago tech community. And we need to do that for sure, because the numbers are still crazy. They're not as bad as the Oscars, but they're pretty intensely narrow still.
You mentioned we lost the bad part of the Amazon, which came with the subsidies. They're right. Seeing that up in Wisconsin now, that Foxconn is not exactly making good on its targets, making good on its promises. Yeah. Some of those subsidies are tied to the delivery of high-paid jobs, six-figure right. jobs. So those subsidies are not coming out of taxpayers' pockets yet. But still, this whole idea that we're going to replace the manufacturing jobs of the days gone by and their high-paid jobs coming here, they're not really living up to that over there. Here in Chicago, we seem to be growing at a good pace and sustainable growth, would you say, Scott?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, on this topic, I would defer mostly to Howard, and this is because of your entire life's work, to be honest.
Yeah, but community.
You gave the by the way, this is a side piece, you gave the shortest introduction to Howard Tolman I've ever heard.
Well, his resume is 17 pages long, and I've known Howard for years, too. But I'm like, gosh, he's done everything in the tech community. He's the guy.
I figured I was going to start talking to, like, the 25 mark after they got done with the... But I think the one thing that's important about this is the... From Howard, he teed it up perfectly. I think the one thing that's interesting is with more, you talked about Cameo before we came on the show, with more Cameos and more of these companies like ClearCover, et cetera, raising real money and hiring a bunch of people, whether they stay on or they let go or the company succeed or they don't succeed, a lot of these people who are getting their opportunity to work in tech and see what a startup is like and just sort of figure out the ebb and flow of being a business operator, I think the city is going to have a lot more repeat founders or new founders that are coming to the table with more experience, and the flywheel motion starts to kind of take its way and move. And that's one of the things that I think is most exciting. It's just like 5 years ago, having conversations on the podcast with founders, the level of depth and the technical knowledge and the operator business knowledge that I'm seeing now versus 5 years ago is, it's not even comparable.
Well, maybe that's why we're seeing more investment dollars flow this way, because that was the concern, Howard, and I remember interviewing you about this 10 years ago even, about how they're not taking Chicago startups as seriously as if you went to Silicon Valley and started the same startup, it seemed.
Yeah. Well, that's for sure, and they're also, we still aren't writing the same kind of checks. I mean, Cameo's money didn't come from Chicago, you know. I think that we're still conservative in terms of the amount of money that we want to give to a business in one tranche. It's not to say that over time we won't step up. We've got Madison Dearborn here. We have huge companies that want to spend $50 or $100 million. But on the West Coast, they, you know, this is the problem with SoftBank. I mean, when a company asks you for $20 million and you give them $100 million, they go crazy. And honestly, I had... you know, the Cameo team at my one of my classes, and they ask Stephen what he was going to do with $50 million, and the answer is he doesn't know, and that's pretty frightening.
That is frightening. You have to have the answer to that, don't you, when you recommend that to an entrepreneur?
There is no answer, you know, because nobody knows what you're going to do over the next umpteen years with $50 million. So his answer was he was going to have his engineers develop ways to make their product more sticky, because one of the issues with Cameo is sort of a one-trick pony. It's like, how many of these are you really going to do? Most of Cameo's growth is international now, I think. And, you know, there's some other opportunities. I mean, I was just talking with the people that run the Grammys, and we were talking about that audience as a consolidated place where you could get a lot of people exposed to Cameo, which maybe they never heard of, you know, Cameo before. But it's tough. I mean, there's a lot of money sloshing around still on the coasts. Chicago is growing in a lot of ways. One of the things that's interesting from what Scott said is startups, you know, after the first 5 or 10 people, don't need to hire the same kind of people. And in fact, what you need are experienced people, and having them come back, that's really where you can support the growth. You know, startups are great for OJT for, you know, this much, and then if they want to scale, they need grown-ups. And so having people move back here who've been extremely well-trained by some of these big West Coast companies is a godsend, because otherwise you couldn't do it. You can't take 100 graduates from the University of Illinois and do much of anything with them beyond a certain extent.
Speaking of the University of Illinois grads, we have to break here for a second, but I want to get back and ask you, how do we keep that talent here? Because if you look at the founders of YouTube and PayPal and Oracle, and there's so many big stories of people who either came through here, U of I in particular, or are from here, and we lose them to the coast. Is that going to continue to happen, or will we be seen as a real tech place to build your business and, you know, you keep the rock stars of the tech community here. Howard's also going to tell us about his cool phone that I only saw at the Consumer Electronics Show, and I'm so jealous. I am so phone envious at this moment because I need that foldable screen, and I might even change to Samsung. So he'll tell us about that. Back with Scott Catoon and Howard Tallman. More Tech Talk on Tech Tuesday coming up. All right, back with Scott Catoon, CEO of TechNori, and Howard Tallman, who he has done so many things, as Scott pointed out earlier. I'm going to read a little more of his resume since you prompted me.
No, please don't.
Scott's like, I didn't do you justice, and I didn't. You currently serve as general managing partner for G2T3V. I've never understood. You won't tell anyone why you came up with that title, but that's okay. Investors in Disruptive Innovators and for the Chicago High-Tech Investors. You also were the leading CEO of the Giant Entrepreneur Startup Incubator, 1871. You're a Kaplan. You founded Tribeca Flashpoint Media Academy. Many people I know have gone through there and gone on to successful careers in media. You've done so many things. I mean, you worked on the Culture Affairs with the mayor. I mean, Howard, what haven't you done? What haven't you done?
Well, I haven't figured out how to get a nomination for De Niro, and he calls me every single day and whines. I mean, they nominated everybody else in that movie, seriously, like in spades.
How ridiculous!
I mean,
is that?
How embarrassing is it? But they hate him. I mean, and he was at the Golden Globes. He was having a really good time.
Yeah,
you know, you rarely
was.
See him
he
laugh and smile. You know, but
even when it was a little awkward.
Yeah.
You founded it with him, didn't you? Flashpoint.
Yeah,
he was a big part of that.
Well, what happened was when you try to create a vocational school, you discover a lot of parents, you know, they don't think vocational is anything. When you add the name Tribeca to vocational school, all of a sudden it's like my kid's going to Bob De Niro's film school.
Yeah.
And lo and behold, it changed the whole sort of posture of that that venture.
It definitely did. And Scott, you regularly feature entrepreneurs on your show.
We try to.
And I want to talk about that. So we see how a lot of these bright young minds leave the city. Is that fair to say? We've seen it in the past. Is it not happening anymore?
I think it's happening a little bit. But, you know, you were talking...
YouTube, PayPal, Oracle. You look at the founders.
Yeah, those are old stories.
We're in a new chapter.
It's happening less. But the big reason it's happening less is what was in the Times on Sunday, which is the tech backlash. Mm-hmm. You know, and the fact that a lot of these big tech companies are having difficulty. I mean, this whole article was about people who just decided they didn't want to go work anymore for any of the big tech companies because they didn't think that the mission, you know, was the same or that the social contributions were the same. And it's, you know, this is a tough area.
It's millennials, it's Generation Z even, who wants to align themselves with the values of a company, and some of the big tech companies don't do that.
I think the recruiters would tell you that if you don't have mission match and value match within the first year, you're not going to keep any employees who are under about 30 years old.
Yeah. How do you match their mission? What are they looking for?
Well, what they're looking for is to make a difference. They want to have a company that shares these new values, and, you know, you mentioned in the last show about Jamie Dimon. I mean, this whole business roundtable stuff about saying, you know, it's not enough just to pay attention to the shareholders' needs. Now you have to take into account all the other constituencies. That's where they're at. You know, that's where they're at. And they want to have a company that they can be proud of. And, you know, it's hard to go home these days and say you work for Facebook. Really hard.
Because your friends give you a hard time.
Totally.
You don't like that kind of scrutiny. Are you okay with that? Is that fine? You can't tweet about it or put it out on social media.
Yeah, it's hard. And I think that's true of almost, you know, it used to be that sort of the villains were Palantir and maybe Oracle. You know, those were and maybe Microsoft another 10 years back, okay?
Yep.
But today, everybody in tech is like under unbelievable scrutiny as to, are you doing every single thing right? And, you know, that's a hard standard. It's an impossible standard.
Well, it is an impossible standard, but there have been some pretty disturbing stories. You look at WeWork and the culture at Uber and some things that needed to be shaken up that didn't make employees even feel comfortable and free of harassment in some cases.
For sure.
That needs to be eliminated. I know you write a column for Inc., you advise entrepreneurs, and you're very direct with your advice. I was like, geez, I wouldn't want to sit with him in an investment meeting. I would not want to sit across from Howard. But what do you tell
me? I got a nasty note from Adam Sandler, by the way. He
what
was
did he
very,
say?
Well, he was aggravated that I said the movie
I saw
was,
that, and I was the, thinking, I was like,
I said the movie was just horrible. It was just the most disgusting. Well, his performance was great, but why would you bother to make a movie about somebody that was that despicable, surrounded by all these despicable people? And So anyway,
when you're a comedian, you've got to stretch the boundaries to get it. If you want to win an Oscar,
listen. That's why I said, you know, that's exactly right. They think that that's validating of their craft or something, but. Mm-hmm. Boy, it was terrible.
But your advice, do you have advice for people about creating that environment in general? I suppose it applies outside the tech community.
I mean, you know, my advice for if you want to be in this business, you know, you need to find really good mentors. And, you know, you don't learn from a bunch of kids who are your age trying to start something. You learn from people who've done it before. So I would say, and again, Robert Blackwell is a perfect example. Go work for somebody smart for a while before you decide that you can go, you know, change the world all by yourself. Because it's harder these days to do it. In fact, I don't know, you know, if somebody brings us 100 apps at 1871, I think we would say 99 of them, forget it, because it's not, it's almost impossible to break through a new app when you have 48,000 going into the Apple Store every month now.
I was looking at Technori's website today, as I like to do before you're on the show, and the top of there was a big Chicago startup that is doing really well and hiring a lot of people.
They aspire to hire a lot of people.
Oh, they're not putting out the for-hire sign yet?
I think he said that in 2020 they were going to try to get 60 to 80 people.
Yep. Yeah.
And I just think that, you know, that's a very aggressive goal. I mean, the city, you know, the old mayor, I don't know about the new mayor, the old mayor loved to have those announcements, you know, and he would just run around
the
city.
You were
spending a lot of time in relativity.
Yeah.
He was hanging out a lot
of time at anybody willing to hire 50 people. But you can't integrate 70 or 80 people into a new business that you're growing and developing at the exact same time successfully unless you're a magician. And so I think, you know, that's a good goal and that's a good objective, but what they need to really do is figure out where do they need the people and what do those people have to do. One of the big mistakes that entrepreneurs make is to think that the first 50 people you hire are going to be engineers.
Yeah.
And the truth is, after you hire your first few engineers, you need everybody but engineers to support your users, to support your customers, to sell your, you know, product. So there's every kind of opportunity. But in Chicago right now, we're going through sort of a shaky period. You know, you have big layoffs at Jelly Vision, you know, and you have a bunch of other companies that are sort of hunkering down because this year is going to be a bumpy year.
Yeah.
We're almost out of time here, gentlemen, but I want to ask you if you think Elon Musk made news yesterday in Vegas because they are saying he is promising delivery of their high-speed transportation device, whatever it is, there to start and break ground this year. We were promised one in Chicago for this, you know, bullet train to O'Hare, or whatever that was.
Sure.
Is that going to happen, Howard Tolman?
Well, it's going to happen in Vegas for the same reason that, you know, I took an autonomous, you know, Uber from the airport to downtown in Vegas for CES last week.
Gee.
If you have perfect weather conditions, if you have no overhead obstructions, if you have the
ability... Don't have to dig under a lake or a river.
If you have the ability to say this street, as of tomorrow, is a thoroughfare for only, you know, self-driving vehicles... you would get it done. If you're in Chicago, you know, we'll be long gone before anybody figures out how to do just the tunneling. You know, I think of the subways in New York, which are on, what, the third or fourth decade of the, you know, Second Avenue subway or whatever it is. You know, way back when, it was intended that there would be an O'Hare hub for downtown. You know, you go right to the Daily Center or something.
We talked about it forever.
Right. And you know what? I mean, they could do it with just express trains. I mean, they don't need a new tunnel. They just have to figure out how to get the other trains out of the way and let the blue line go straight to the airport.
All right. That's going to do it there for Tech Tuesday. Thank you, Howard Tolman.
Sure.
His resume is too long to re-talk about, but I hope you come back again and we'll mention it again. And Scott Catoon of Technori.
Thanks.
Good to see you guys.
Of course. Thank you.
Back with more here on WGN Radio in a moment. Anna DeVlantis here in the Skyline Studios, along with Chef Tyler Nixon. Hi, Tyler.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for having me.
I'm glad you're here, and I think people will be surprised to understand what it is you're doing, but maybe even interested once they learn a little more about what it is you do.
I would hope so. That's the aim of it.
So. Yeah, so, I mean, okay, so it's marijuana dinner parties. Is it your focus now, your passion, or is it your full-time job?
It started off as kind of like a hobby passion, something that I was just doing in between working at restaurants, and now it's a full-fledged job, something that I'm doing every week, somebody else's home or venue.
So you're a chef. You come to people's homes. You do marijuana dinner parties. You have tips about dosing, ambiance, and right. avoiding a buzzkill. You don't want people to get too overserved with marijuana.
Right.
But it does blend really well with different foods and drinks. You're going to explain that piece of it. But I want to understand a little more about you first, if you don't mind, because you've worked with Michelin star chefs in the past. You made a career. Your dad's a restaurateur at Wishbone.
Right.
Joel, people love Wishbone for years and years.
Wishbone's a Chicago classic. I like to think so, but...
I would say so. Did you grow up working there at all?
Yeah, Too young, for sure. I started,
Labor laws didn't apply when you're family.
My father always said that the labor laws didn't apply to family restaurants.
What all restaurant owners say. My dad owned a restaurant, too, so I understand these things. Did you like the restaurant business initially, or did you say, I'm not so sure about this, my dad's forcing me into it? How'd you feel?
I always loved it. I've always been fascinated by the connections that my father has made in the restaurant industry, and Wishbone's always been talked about very highly around me, so I always had put my father and Wishbone on such a pedestal that at a very young age I was definitely gunning for to be a cook.
To serve food, and your dad does it well too. He somehow incorporated Southern cooking into Chicago, and is one of the few places you can get that done well. So it's like, go there and get the biscuits and do all of it.
Great shrimp and grits, for sure.
Oh, so. Gosh, that makes my Saturday and Sunday morning. Separate issue. I just want to ask you, though, about then you went on to work with some really big chefs and some big establishments, some fine dining and other types of restaurants. Tell us about them, where you went.
Yeah, I started off, working at Wishbone, which is, very simple, basic cooking. I learned a lot of the essentials, and then, anytime I ever got in trouble at school or something, my dad would send me off to go work with some other chef in the city, which started off with like the red light with Chef Jackie Shen.
And on Randolph.
On Randolph, yeah. That was like one of my first outside of Wishbone Kitchen jobs. I was like 16. And then the Duck Inn in Bridgeport, when that opened up, Kevin Hickey was a great mentor to me and worked for him for some years. And then I moved on to 16 and Coda de Volpa. I've been at a lot of restaurants around the city, but...
You wanted to do your own thing.
Yeah, I wanted to do my own thing. Yeah, I grew up in a weird time in Chicago, too, where it felt like everybody was kind of doing their own thing. Everyone growing up seemed to have, very young, was doing very well, and I didn't want to end up being a dead-end cook, and I just...
You were at some of the best restaurants there are.
Exactly, yeah, but, you always have that fear in the back of your head that, So I started doing my own supper clubs and dinner series and selling tickets online, and...
So you made the move to marijuana.
I did.
And you were someone who was using marijuana medically.
Yeah. Medically. I wouldn't never, not maybe legally medically, but definitely I was medicating with it. I grew up very impulsive. I was a very impulsive child. I was a kid who'd like push every elevator on the, every button on the elevator. And so
you're ADHD.
Very ADHD, very impulsive. So it, from an early age, I remember reading that marijuana gave a lot of the effects of stimulants that are given for ADHD, but without a lot of the negative side effects that are given with them. So I remember experimenting with it maybe a little too young, but it always had a very good impact on me.
Yeah. So then you moved into say, hey, I'm going to combine the two. This does something for me. Now I'm a chef and you're creating these dinner parties now.
Yeah. And working in the restaurants, you realize that a lot of chefs have that use marijuana for, whether it's insomnia issues or, depression or anything, it's very commonly used in the kitchen world,
or stress, or any number of things that people are now long turning day. To it for.
Right.
I think the stigma is slowly going away. It's certainly there as recreational has become legal in a lot of spots across the state. The other interesting stat here I just want to say before we get into your menus and how you do this is that older adults are actually fueling the recreational pot use, that older adults are now having.
Right, and that's why most of my dinners are filled with more first-timer cannabis users, people very interested in the experience that aren't really big smokers or are just trying to get like a glimpse into that culture a little bit.
What's the average age, would you say?
I'd say like 40. Mm-hmm. I'd say 40 is probably the average age at our dinners.
Okay. And so what do you do? How does this work for someone like me who's never been to the marijuana dinner party?
It's important to be, I don't really do these as like a means for you to get super baked. And, it's more of just like...
It's not about getting high. It's about enjoying this unique culinary experience.
Yeah, and exposing people to the fact that along with getting rid of the stigma behind cannabis, but highlighting it as like a gourmet product more or less.
Mm-hmm. So what does it work well with? What's the typical, what would be a menu? Lead us through, and then you do it with food
right,
and
yeah.
with
so
drink.
It's almost like wines in the sense of, like, if you look at it from, like, a color and depth scale, you know, like, I would pair more lighter, fluffier strains of cannabis with lighter food items. Rather, I would take more heavier, darker strains, like a wine, like a Zinfandel or something like that, and pair those more with, like, you know, steaks or heavier dishes. But it's really a smell thing, you know. It's like the terroir is, you know, something that is very important to cannabis and wine, you know. You can taste and smell and regionally where it's from, or just the smell of cannabis gives you a lot of different flavor profiles.
Do you infuse it into the food? Because, I mean, this isn't marijuana brownies you're talking about. You're talking about food items.
Right, yeah. Oh, yeah. No, it's definitely a step up from pot brownies for sure. It's
I kind of get that sense.
Yeah, definitely. You know, and it's I definitely infuse it into the food, but, you know, there's a science and kind of like a way to do that where it doesn't mix with alcohol and make people feel really crappy at the end of the dinner, you know. So it's making sure that you use THC in the beginning of the meal, because it takes about an hour for cannabis that's consumed to even feel an effect. So starting that part of it early, but I like to highlight it more as an actual pairing. So, like, with a vaporizer or something that's like a very clean smoke, like a volcano vaporizer or something, I'll pass that around as an actual pairing, you know, make it more of an experience.
Like a wine, like a fine wine.
Like a wine, exactly, yeah. Because, like, if you had a pairing at a Michelin star dinner and they told you that this glass of wine, you wouldn't feel it for an hour, you might feel a little iffy about that glass of wine. So it just plays better to the experience of having it as an actual pairing when you ingest it, other than through the food.
So what's popular at the parties? What are you starting to see as you've done this for some time now and been at a number of different people's homes, I assume, is
right,
where you do
yeah,
it?
Right, yeah, yeah. So, yeah, it plays differently depending on everybody that wants me to come to their home. I wouldn't say that it turns into, like, some giant pot party all the time where people are, like, bringing their own cannabis and ingesting their own cannabis. It's more of it's more of an experience just tailored around cannabis and fine dining food. It's not so much as, like, some big pot party.
Right.
As a lot of people would think, but it's different on whoever wants to book me for their home, you know.
And is it marijuana is differentiated from the CBD, which doesn't have the same psychoactive
right.
qualities?
No,
do you
it does
do
not.
Both? It doesn't have the THC.
You do both. You do to create a full spectrum experience. You would add CBD into the experience just so that you can have every part of the plant. But yeah, so CBD, technically, I always stand by, you know, THC early in the meal, CBD at the end of the meal. CBD counteracts the effects of THC. So if you get a little too wonky, a little CBD will bring you back down mm-hmm. to a mellow state.
This is a new world for me, and I think it's fascinating. Where can people find you, Tyler? Tyler Nixon, it's Chef Tyler Nixon is our guest, I should say, and how yeah. do they find you?
You know, I'm all over Instagram. You can find me at Chefy Dahmer on Instagram and
Chefy
Cheffy Dahmer on Instagram. And okay. I'm at Wishbone Restaurant every morning. So feel free to come in there and come say hi.
I'm surprised about who comes to these parties. You ever look around and go, oh, it's kind of surprising.
Yeah, definitely. All the time. Yeah, it definitely growing up consuming cannabis, it's definitely interesting to see older adults come and experience it as well. So it's definitely, people are opening their eyes, and it's becoming more of a socially acceptable thing.
Well, thanks for telling us all about your biz,
yeah.
and good luck with everything.
Thank you
and
so much for having me.
See you at Wishbone. Okay,
yes,
Tyler?
Please.
More to come here on WGN Radio. Trending topics, including the story that was trending during the LSU-Clemson game last night that had nothing to do with the game. Back live in the Skyline Studios, this is Anna DeVlantis, along with Lauren Lapka and Kim Gordon. Also joining us here to talk about trending topics. Guys, did you watch the LSU-Clemson game last night? I know you did, Lauren.
I watched part of it, yeah.
Because you guys are big into football at your mm-hmm. house, right, Kim, too? I know Lauren knows sports better than most.
Big into football. We love football. Doesn't
yeah.
matter if it's your team or not. We just love football.
Super exciting game. And one of the things about it that was trending afterwards was Vince Vaughn going over, shaking hands with the president. He was seated in the skybox, sitting next to the president, Melania. And the internet went crazy about this. They went nuts. The whole cancel culture came out, and everybody thought, oh my gosh, this is terrible. What is he doing? What's happening? And it just, you know, to see that kind of reaction, I think still is like, what is going on?
Yeah, again, I get if you don't like President Trump. I get if you love him. Either way, whichever side you're on, mm-hmm. I think we should all strive to be polite human beings, which is exactly what Vince Vaughn was doing.
Exactly.
And you're right next to him.
You're at a football game.
It's about football, right? It's just about your country, and you know, that's what it's about. It was, you know, it was interesting. There was one tweet that did, thankfully, at the end of the night, get a lot of retweets, and people were into it, because I think it sort of weighed both sides together very nice in a little bit of a sarcastic tweet. Media, he's from The Hill, The Hill media reporter, Joe Concha said, so do swingers and wedding crashers get taken off the air now for all eternity because Vince Vaughn had a civilized conversation with the president at the Superdome tonight? He was responding to a lot of tweets that were sort of suggesting just that.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. It really is. People love to read too much into situations.
Right. You've successfully proven that Vince Vaughn is a Republican. Of course, Vince Vaughn's from Chicago and has Republican donors in his family and counts them. But he identifies in interviews as an independent or a libertarian.
Right. And
Ron
who
and Rand
cares
Paul.
Either
who cares?
Way?
Honestly, you're right. Who cares? That is exactly the point,
it's
Lauren Lapka.
About accepting people who don't necessarily view things the same way you do.
Exactly.
Well, and that's the beauty of sports, too, is it brings all people together.
Mm-hmm.
And you can all agree on one thing.
One would hope.
You would hope.
One would think.
Yes, that LSU is so much better. No, just kidding.
She's starting stuff. Surprised that LSU won?
Not at all.
No. That was pretty cool to see.
Clemson actually did way better than I thought in terms of keeping up. They're a great football team, obviously.
Right. Super exciting game. Super fun to watch. The whole thing. Remember when Ellen took all that heat, too, similarly?
Yeah, for sitting next to George Bush.
Mm-hmm.
Because he has, you know, shared his views on the LGBTQ community. But she made a great point that, you know, a lot of times to sway people to be more accepting is by proving that you, if you are identified with that group, are accepting that they believe that, you know, their beliefs are correct. Mm-hmm. And just show that you are a good person and you are accepting of their thoughts and beliefs.
Take time maybe to talk to them about what your thoughts are. Share a moment like that. That's what she said. She had an excellent response to that on her show. Just
always
talking
be
about
the bigger person.
Thank you, Lauren. Those are very good lessons.
And
here,
you know, and the real heartwarming story was the story of the LSU coach who lost his daughter-in-law in that plane crash.
Sad. Did you see that?
I mean, that was just heart-wrenching.
You saw the tribute they did to her.
It was
and this
so,
young and life and just, oh my gosh, how talented she was.
So talented. And she was a very well-known sports reporter in that area, you know, in the Louisiana area. So
yeah. She wasn't on my radar, so she was a more of a Louisiana.
I think she was more of a local Louisiana sports reporter.
God, she... Yeah, very sad. I know they started out sort of the coverage talking about her and that kind of thing, that backstory. Really heartbreaking. All right, here locally, Chicago zip codes. Top five most expensive Chicago zip codes from Property Shark. First place, Kenilworth, 60043. Then you've got the Winnetka, 60093. Hinsdale coming in third, Glencoe fourth, and Gulf, 60029, with an average about almost $700,000 for the home.
Interesting.
Meanwhile, the mega mansions of the rich and famous here locally still sit on the market in Chicago. A lot of people have asked me, they say, what's going on with that Michael Jordan mega man? I say, Did you ever sell that?
No, it's been around forever, hasn't it?
It's still on the market, stubbornly priced at $14.9 million for the 56,000 square foot compound in Highland Park.
I think it's dropped significantly, too, over the years, the price.
Right. It started out in the 20s or something higher than that, maybe even. Oh, here. His asking price has been cut a number of times. $29 million in 2012 was the original asking price. Went down to $21 million 2 years later. Then saw it fail to sell at an auction that had a $13 million reserve price. Relisted at 16, asking to 14. Now you can scoop it up for $14.9 million.
Wow.
If you're interested in the full-size basketball court.
Yeah, any millionaires, you know, not already have their mansions.
It's a kind of thing because it's so unique to him, right? Mm-hmm. He's got 23 on the gates. I don't know everything that's inside of it, but it does seem like he built his palace, and it might not be right for everybody.
No, but it's Chicago, and if you're from the area, you love MJ.
Well,
so
the thing too is it's been sitting for so long, I'm sure it needs redecorating because everything's old.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that may be it. You're right. This
it
kitchen
probably needs a big update.
So then you got to build that into the price, too. That's a good point. Good point. The Perillo's $45 million Lincoln Park listing, if you've ever been on Halsted Street there, it backs up against Halsted Street. It looks like a public library, if you've seen it before, with the colonnades. It's got the limestone finish. 25,000 square foot mansion owned by the United Auto Insurance guy. The CEO, Richard Perillo, and his wife, listed for $50 million in 2016, still sitting there at $45 million.
That one's still sitting. Richard Marks, his place is still on the market, too. So
really?
That's in Lake Bluff. Yeah. Huh. Big manse there. But that one seems like it has an offer on it. So that may be one of the mega mansions that's selling. All right, this is interesting, guys. Listen to this. This is why Costco always checks your receipts. So you might think the biggest reason is shoplifting or preventing that. So, hey, did you really buy that stuff that's in your cart or in your bags or in your boxes, whatever you brought with you? But the real major reason is, surprisingly, that the Costco employees say that they're checking for Costco employee theft. And they're also checking receipts to make sure that everything was properly scanned, that they're not just sending a TV through or some high-priced, high-dollar thing through.
Like coordination.
That was not scanned. Not scanned. So that's the pretty simple. We want to make sure they're not getting overcharged, but we also want to make sure that things aren't escaping from the inventory that are going unnoticed. Part of the plan. So that's what they check as well.
Well, yeah, definitely hard to hide one of those under your shirt. Or, you know, like a 80,000 pack of toilet paper. So
right. It's like the bulk stuff. Yeah. It's kind of easy to see it. It really is. The Costco stuff in general. Although they have rings, diamond rings at Costco.
They do?
I think there's a section for that. They have all that. They have everything. All right. Meteorite contains 7 billion year old stardust. Oldest ever discovered. The oldest solid material ever found on Earth. Just found in Australia. Meteorite fell 50 years ago in Australia, contained stardust that formed 5 to 7 billion years ago. So now scientists are looking into it to see, I guess they use exposure age data to determine the actual age, and that's what they found.
I wonder how people know that when they're walking across this random rock, that it's something of significance.
Right. How do you know? How do you know? Well, apparently it's now been surveyed by a graduate student at the Field Museum and University of Chicago, who says that she says it's the next best thing to being able to take a sample directly from a star. So they're excited about the history and the things that it reveal about our galaxy. Pretty cool. Speaking of, this is a teenager who might be interested in that. Did you see the teenager who discovered a new planet just a couple days into interning at NASA?
What?
No. Like, he's there for a couple days. He's like, hey, what's that?
Was that luck or he's a genius?
I think he's in that genius category. He's a 17-year-old senior who was doing an internship at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center. And he made a cosmic discovery that he's like, it looked like a planet. And he brought it to the other scientists at NASA. And sure enough, he discovered a planet.
That's cool. Did they name it after him?
He said he doesn't know what he is going to name it. I think they're giving him that option, although his brother and friends are kind of weighing in to try to tell him what it should
be
called.
Super Gen Z. some super Gen Z name.
Hopefully it's not like.
Or not Gen Z.
Yeah, that's what he'd be. Yeah, he'd be Z. So it's after the millennials. So 18 years old, and that's what he does. Some super popular childhood foods. Listen to this. Foods and drinks that completely vanished without you noticing until right now. You may be too young for some of these, Lauren. But remember certs?
Oh, of course.
They went
Sounds
missing.
Familiar.
Those are missing.
It's a breath mint.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I remember those.
You do?
Yeah.
I totally remember those. I remember they came in all kinds of cool flavors, and they were really small. They weren't like I guess Altoids and Tic Tacs.
They're like
the
size
over.
Of a dime, don't
yes,
you think?
Yes, that's exactly right. Mm-hmm. Right. They weren't as small as a Tic Tac.
A little thicker, though, than a dime.
Right. So it's that has gone away. And the Bubblicious cotton candy gum. I totally remember that. I love the cotton candy gum. That's gone. Altoid Sours. Remember they revealed that product?
Oh, I love anything sour.
You did? I really did not like those.
You're mentally thinking mint and you get sour, then it's like gross. Your brain is like, no.
There's a whole bunch of them if you want to check it out. It's on BuzzFeed. I remember all of them, and some of them I do really miss. And you're like, oh, yeah, that went away. Finally, let's just end with this. Jeff Bezos, do you see this? He's being slammed for Amazon only donating $690,000 to the Australian wildfires, while many other celebs worth less than him are donating a lot more. So he's taking
such
some heat.
Such a cheapskate.
They're saying he makes like $250,000 like an hour. So maybe
that's only
2 or 3 hours worth of work there. But I don't know. I don't know how you can really, really go after someone
at least
for doing a good
money.
Deed. Yeah. Yes. Thank you to Jeff Bezos. That's going to do it for Trending Topics. Right now, we're going to be back with us for a couple minutes and then to the Rokan Show. Check in to see what he's got coming up at the top of the hour after the news from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom.